Mel and I and the rest of the people who signed to the tech net, eventually we're going to get to the bottom of all of this mystery about ham radio. How does radio and wireless really work, and how to make it work better? Appropriate questions are usually about things like batteries and charging networks and transmission lines and antennas, favored rigs, transmitters, receivers, methods of propagation, and the 26 different kinds of ham radio. There's obviously a lot to be learned. And Mel and I and other people who sign into this net, from time to time we get some very nice compliments about the service that we're providing, the information we're conveying, and some people develop a little bit more understanding and figure out how to make their equipment work a little bit better. So with your help, we'll continue doing that. The subjects that are discussed on the TechNet are the subjects that you guys bring to the TechNet as questions. Most of the time, Mel and I don't have a schedule of what we're going to present. You guys make that determination. There are some exceptions. Mel has, in the past, for instance, given specific lectures on the subject of the Smith chart, a very useful technique. And there's obviously more to be learned about that. We haven't completely covered that subject. Alrighty, the person with a question or a comment signs into the net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, because I'm so forgetful, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, N2EO, Rich and Yes. Rich is a very frequent sign-in. So do we have any check-ins tonight? One at a time, go slow, we'll get you all. Please give me your call letters and name at this time, K2RIW listening.
W-H-O-R-Y, Joe. Question? Yes.
Into G-O-T, Howard?
No.
Into 2-M-D-P, Steve, and no question.
Kilo, Charlie, 2, Mike, Bravo, Victor, Franco, no.
W2, Papa Alpha 5, Kilo Lima, hey, no question.
WB7, AVF, Rob, no question, yes.
Okay, so far we have Joe with a yes. Another Joe with a yes. First one was QIW, the second one was RYY. Howard with a no, Steve with a no, Franco with a no, and the W2, I think it was HPL, with a no. Who have we missed so far? K2RIW listening.
You have Paul with a yes earlier on, right, Dick? WS2N?
Sure do, Paul.
Hey, Miss Tommy, I got a call.
Okay, Tommy, I think you said you've got a yes. If so, please give me your call letters.
KC2JLK. No question, just listen.
Okay, JLK. Anyone else?
WB7AVF, New York. Good evening, Dick. Rob, no question is a yes. I'm listening. Thanks.
Very fine, Rob. Let's start off with the first show. Mr. QIW, I think it's KC2QIW, if I'm not sure. But go ahead, right ahead with your question, Joe. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
And I got my radio back. The driver transistor went out, and I sent it up to U2, and they fixed it. All right, so let me give it back to Dick.
Okay, for possibly the DL tone was not operating correctly or we timed out the machine. I know you were asking a question about your 440 rig and is it more popular than 2 meters, is what I think you were asking, Joe. I started hearing you on the input when I started switching over to the input. Joe, just to be sure I got your question, why don't you repeat the beginning of it, K2RIW, and start over to call letter, Joe.
Let me give it back to Dick.
Okay, and now see what's going on. Each time you make a transmission, for the first 20 seconds, your PL tone is low or something is peculiar happening because you're not coming through the machine, but I'm hearing you on the input. And in the second half, you start coming through the machine. That happened twice in a row. So maybe the PL tone's a little bit on the low side there. 2-meter handy-talkies and 2-meter FM repeater work is by far the most popular kind of ham radio that I know of. And maybe Mel and Paul and others will give us confirmation of that. Of the people who go to 440, their main reason for doing it is to get away from the extra crowded conditions they sometimes sense on 2 meters, particularly during drive times. They do it as a little bit more of an exclusivity type thing. That's my impression. There are a lot more spaces, so to speak, available spaces on 440, so that's a driving force. Now, talk to a person who is very heavy into 440 activity, and quite possibly he'll tell you that, gee, 440 is better than 2 meters, to each his own. You tend to have a little bit less range on 440. Foliage gives you a little bit more absorption. The antenna itself is a little bit smaller, therefore it has a slightly smaller effective capture area. The bottom line of that is you have a little bit more free space loss. In other words, two handy-talkies on 440 a mile apart will have not quite as strong a signal to each other as a pair of 2 meters handy-talkies a mile apart. That's just sort of the physics of higher frequencies. Higher frequencies are capable of longer range if you have the same number of square feet of antenna devoted to the project. In other words, two space-borne satellites, space probes, with equal-sized parabolic dish antennas aimed at each other, the higher frequency will, because of greater directivity, send more signal in the right direction, and you have a stronger signal strength. Well, we amateurs with a rubber duck antenna on the handy-talkie tend not to keep the effective area of the antenna the same. A smaller 440 rubber duck has a little bit less area than a 2-meter rubber duck, so to speak. So you get a little bit less range. Some people have rigs that have both 220 and 2 meters and 440, and they use both of them. But I think the 2 meters gets used a little bit more. Now, those are some of my opinions. I haven't been a great 440 user, so possibly I'm not giving it a fair shake. I have, for a lot of years, been an extremely serious user of 432 megacycle sideband by way of a stripline parallel kilowatt amplifier. I talked to people in, I think about 28 states, many of them on single
repeaters, timeout,
many of them on single sideband with, I guess some of my best ranges were down to Florida and Alabama and out to Iowa, places like that, up to Maine, Nova Scotia. So 432 megacycles with the right kind of equipment on single sideband can do some very exciting work. However, I'm going to admit it to you that on a Tuesday afternoon at 3 in the afternoon, you call single sideband 432 megacycle CQ, and there's a 95% chance you're not going to get an answer. Do the same thing on 2-meter FM, and there's a 90% chance you will get an answer, particularly if you choose certain repeaters. Each has its purpose. So maybe that's some of the answers you were looking for, Joe. I think it's KC2QIW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
B2HWW with a comment to the subject.
Okay, once again, I'm hearing you on the input show, but I'm not hearing you coming through the machine. Howie, go right ahead with your comment.
Okay, as far as the New York area and Los Angeles, is most major U.S. cities, big cities, such as New York, 440 is more popular for a couple of reasons. One, it covers better within the city. Yes, if you're out in the boondocks, VHF will do better. But due to the fact that the end...
Okay, yeah. How are you cut off very suddenly due to the fact? But up till then, we heard you very well. So Howie, a user of 440 by way of his repeater. He has repeaters on 2 meters, 10 meters, and 440 under his call letters, I believe. And so they, in metro areas, how he feels that 440 is more useful. Greater coverage between the buildings, and I guess he's saying actually more activity. So in metro areas, quite possibly that's what many people will find. Both have their usefulness. But this is the best of all worlds. I guess, Joe, you'd like to have a rig on both bands, a dual-band rig. Make sure that your PL tone is turned on, Joe, on 136.5 hertz, because I'm hearing you on the input, but the first 15 or so seconds of each one of your transmissions, for reasons I don't completely understand, is not coming through the repeater. KC2QIW. And I think that's your call letters, Joe. K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, Roger, that's my call sign there. I just got this radio back from E2. They had to work on it. They replaced the driver transistor. They had to repair it, and I'm trying to get the right PO tone. So the name here is Joe, and this is KC2 Quebec Yankee Whiskey. And yeah, thank you very much for the answers. And let me give it back to the net. Hope I got it right this time.
WB2HWW, you want to finish up the comment, battery died?
Yeah, go ahead, Howie.
I don't know where I stopped my comments, but it's been a UHF user for many years. In the New York City area, Los Angeles, and major metropolitan areas, there's more activity on UHF. As far as coverage is concerned, in the city, UHF works better because the signal bounces around better. We notice better signal because smaller antennas work better on rubber duckies, they're more efficient, and the repeater antennas give you more gains. So in the New York area, but in smaller towns or on the roads, V2MEAS is much busier outside of New York. So such places as New York, Boston, Washington, D.C., stuff like that, UHF is much more popular. There's more activity, and it's easy to get a UHF channel. It's easy to get a VHF channel these days than it is to get a UHF channel. Back to you, Dick.
N2EIJ. N2EIJ. Thank you very much for those comments, Howie. N2EIJ, start with your name, sir, and tell us, are you checking in, or do you have a yes or a no? What is start up with your name, Mr. EIJ?
My name is Andrew. Just want to make a statement here. You fellas are talking about 2 meters 440. Consider 220. I belong to the Yonkers Amateur Radio Club, and we recently installed a repeater on 224.96 with an 88.5 PL. Got good coverage and very low interference. That's all I wanted to say. Back to net, N2EIJ.
Good information, Andrew. So what Andrew is saying is that if you want to get away from the crowd, have your own private repeater, so to speak, because not as much equipment is available on 220. It's not it's quite as popular. Therefore, a little more privacy and a little less crowded conditions can definitely exist on 220 or 224, where Joe is using it in the Yonkers area. I think you said PL is on 88 hertz. Did I get that correct, Joe? 224.96 is your repeater, and PL, I think you said, is 88. Back to you, Andrew, for a repeat.
That's where I get. The frequency is 224.94, and the PL is 88.5, and it's an open repeater. Go ahead.
Very fine, Andrew. 224.94, 88.5 is the PL. And an open repeater in the Yonkers area. Okay. So more of us should be collecting 220 equipment, too. If this is the best of all worlds, I guess I'd like to have a mobile rig that's equipped on 6 meters, 2 meters. Well, wait a minute now. We shouldn't keep Howie out of this one. He's got a beautiful repeater on 29 meg. So we'd like to have a mobile rig that's got 29 meg repeat capability, 6 meters, 2 meters, 224, 440, and maybe even 902 to 928 megs, and 1296 as I call it. Each of those bands have got their advantages. There is a repeater run by this particular club, which is on the Empire State Building, which is on 1296 megacycles, approximately, at least it's on the 23 centimeter band. I suspect the range is a little bit shorter on that one, and the amount of equipment available is a little bit less popular and a little bit more expensive. But for people who want a little bit more exclusivity, don't knock it. Good way to go. Good question you brought to our attention, Joe. And I hope that your new rig with the new final amplifier is giving you some pretty nice service. Okay, we got two more people on the list, Joe and Paul in that order. Joe number two, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. We'll discuss anything except intermodulation, distortion, noise figure, or dynamic range of receivers. That was a joke, Joe. Back to you, Joe. T2LAW in the deck net.
Well, I put me after the other guy had a question because I just want to do something until about 9 o'clock, and so hopefully you'll get done with him before that or maybe a little after that if you follow me. So put me at the end of the list, Dick. Thank you. W-A-2-R-Y-Y.
Okay. If I sense correctly what Joe's saying, he's busy until 9 o'clock, and so we'll come back to you at that time or maybe a little bit before that. Paul, WS2N, you're the only other person that I know of that signed in who's got a real question, so we got lots of time for you. Go nice and slow, and give us your question, Paul. WS2N, our space expert, K2LIW in the deck net.
Okay, Dick. I don't think it's going to be a long question. I read your article, the CQ magazine March issue, and all about the array that was up there on the tower. And it was a good, excellent article. And then when you said that the whole thing eventually came down during Hurricane Gloria in 1985, it made me think, here we are going into hurricane season. I was wondering, what was were you able to determine the failure where it let loose? I know you had it designed for a certain miles per hour. It really wasn't going to handle a hurricane, like, I think, over 100 miles an hour. So I was wondering, what broke loose? Something near the top, holding to the tower? Did the top of the tower come down? Did the whole tower come down? I was just wondering what was the main failure point? Did the guy wise break and the whole thing go? You know, give us a couple words on that if you could, Dick. Back to you, WS2N.
Okay, good set of questions. What Paul's referring to is the March issue 2008 of CQ Ham Radio Magazine. First or second article in the magazine is called The Magic of Radio or The Magic of Wireless, written by K2RIW, supposedly. Well, I supplied a lot of the information to the editor of the magazine who converted it all into a very nice article. It all started because the editor had been driving home, heard the technical net, and heard me discuss the fact that I was using this array of 16 Yagis to talk 480 miles down to K4CAW in Greensboro, North Carolina. I was doing that from approximately 1980 to 1984, I think it was, about a 4 or 4.5 year period of time. It all got started because I put up this array of 16 Yagis. I knew it would have a whole lot of gain. I thought I was going to give it an elevation control and start doing moon bounce with it, but because it was on 100 feet of tower, could clear my 70-foot high trees, my land is 300 feet above sea level, relatively high by Long Island standards, and I look out over the water. So therefore, with that array of 16 Yagis, I was able to talk to people in, a total of 460 different ham radio operators on 432 sideband. I talked to with that antenna with a kilowatt of sideband power going into it from an Echo 70, not very high class, mobile type Echo 70 2-meter correction 440 sideband rig. The first time I talked to K4CAW and realized he's 480 miles away, where about 480 miles, 400 of it is overland, we were kind of amazed. That was in the summertime. We talked to each other one Tuesday night, and we said, gee, that much range, my radio horizon is out there 40 miles, and here we are talking 480 miles, 43 miles is my radio horizon, and we're talking 480 miles. He had an array of four Yagis on 100 feet of tower. I had my array of 16 Yagis on 100 feet of tower. So we said, gee, let's try it again next Tuesday night and see what'll happen. Well, to make a long story short, we eventually did it every single Tuesday night from 7:30 to 8 o'clock for 4.5 years, summer, winter, spring, and fall. We averaged in the wintertime about 90-95% copy. Signals were only a few dB above the noise. It was real threshold stuff. What was kind of fun about it all was that the people on both ends of the circuit hear us every Tuesday night for a half hour, and they didn't hear the other side of the conversation. So groups of hams in his neighborhood, groups of hams in my neighborhood, were both accusing each of us for creating a hoax, that we're really on the telephone and making believe we're making an extremely long-range ham radio contact. Well, after a after a few years of that, the guy should have realized that, boy, that would be really racking up one hell of a phone bill if we were creating a hoax. Pretty soon there were some guys in the midpoint on the mountaintops in Virginia that would aim their antennas back and forth in the two directions and say, hey, these guys are really doing it. And pretty soon the so-called hoax became a reality. That antenna of mine was made out of very thin wall light tubing. That whole array had 400 square foot of radio area. It was 16 and a half feet wide, 15 and a half feet high, 13 feet deep. It was 3,500 cubic feet of antenna. So 16 Yagis, the only way I could get them past the 12 guy wires and get them on top of the tower was to assemble them in chunks and bring up the four chunks one at a time and put them together right at the 100-foot level. That's how the antenna was constructed. But thin wall tubing, and had a calculated wind failure of around 76 miles an hour. Each individual Yagi was rated for something like 75 miles an hour by RIW Products, which is my good friend W2KRM, who was manufacturing those antennas at the time. Hurricane Gloria hit me at something like 105 miles an hour of wind. As I said, the antenna had an array, had a calculated wind failure of 76 miles an hour. It weighed something like 75 pounds total. 25 pounds of that was just the phasing harness, just the coax cables made out of FM8 and all the 4-to-1 power dividers that were involved in the thing. I guess a total of five of those. So it was a very light construction antenna that wrapped around the tower, so to speak. With 105 mile an hour wind, the main horizontal bar failed, and therefore it came apart in two major great big chunks and deposited itself right in the middle of my front lawn. I could tell the wind at the top of the tower was really fierce because the top 10 feet of my Roan number 6 tower bent over at a 30-degree angle. The whole tower stood. The guy wires did their job as they're supposed to, but the top 10 feet of the tower was bent at a 30-degree angle, and all the antennas were displayed, deposited into my front lawn. I straightened out the tower by putting another piece of guy wire on the top of it, and pulling it straight by connecting that with a come-along to a tree in the right direction. In other words, I looked around for what have I got that can bend a Roan number 6 tower section back straight, and the strongest thing I had around was the 90 feet of tower that was below that particular section. So I straightened it out right on station, so to speak, with me not on the tower at the time, standing on the ground, making sure everything came out correctly, and I confirmed that everything was bent back straight and strong, and then I was able to climb the tower and disconnect that extra piece of guy wire. That by far was the most fun antenna, let me drop, I had ever used. Because the gain of that antenna was 29 dB over ISO, about 27 dB over dipole was the gain of that array of 16 Yagis. 19 elements per Yagi, 16 of them, 304 elements total. As I said, 29 dB gain over isotropic. When I pressed key down with a kilowatt into that antenna, I had more than half a megawatt of effective radiated power. At first you would say, gee, that sounds pretty dangerous. Well, it spread out over 400 square feet. The actual watts per square meter is a pretty low number. You could stand in front of that antenna safely if you would stand at the 100-foot level on a great big you know, hook and ladder, so to speak. 5 foot in front of an antenna, you can stand there, and it would actually be safe, because its gain is made up of a whole lot of area, and it's spreading the RF energy over that area when it does its transmitting. As I said, it was the most fun antenna I ever built. Because of its extra gain, I had roughly 3 times the range I would have for the more simple antenna. 3 times more radius, area is pi r squared. I had almost 10 times more area of people I could talk to, more than 10 times as many hands to talk to, so to speak. I was having so much fun talking to the 460 guys on 432 sideband, sometimes at some pretty nice distances, but I never got around to doing moonbounce. I was going to put an elevation control in the antenna, never got around to doing it. I was ending up just picking people's brains. In those days, and this was 1980 to 1985, most of the guys on 432 had to do a lot of home brewing. The final amplifier you had to home brew, maybe the exciter you could buy, a high gain antenna you had to home brew. That antenna also had a relay built in the phasing harness, which I called a zoom control. I could control the beamwidth of the antenna. So as I said, I was having so much fun with that, I never got around to doing moonbounce. I never got around to beefing it up to make it stronger to support a higher wind load. I know that a beyond 75 mile an hour wind is a once per 50 year event in my neighborhood. So unfortunately, the once per 50 year event occurred 5 years after I put it up. Because I had so much fun with that antenna, I've been looking forward to reproducing that. I now have a slightly stronger Rhone 55 tower, a lot stronger than my Rhone 6 tower I was using at that time, and I'm looking forward to someday reproducing that antenna and maybe even a slightly larger version of it. As I said, it was the most fun antenna I ever used. By way of that zoom control, I could set it for a broad beamwidth called a general area CQ. If somebody gave me an answer, I could easily aim the antenna in that direction because of a broad beamwidth. Then I would flip the relays to go to the more narrow beamwidth, and the guy would either get 6 or 12 dB stronger out of the noise when I went to the more narrow beamwidth and zoomed in on the guy, so to speak. During a ham radio during a ham radio contest, that could be a lot of fun. On 3 occasions, I took first place in the Hudson Division, one of the major divisions in the United States, in the June or September VHF contest by using nothing but 432 megacycles. Didn't use 6 meters, 2 meters, 220, 1296 or whatever. Nothing but 432, and took top score for the Hudson Division, which includes a major portion of New Jersey, Long Island, and southern New York State. So as you can see, I had a lot of enjoyment out of the antenna. I'm looking forward to putting it back up again someday now that I've got a stronger tower. I'm thinking of even putting 2 of those antennas up all, would you believe, one vertically stacked above the other, and I'll aim one of them towards the Boston area, which is a very big VHF, UHF area of activity, aim the other one towards Philadelphia, where the pack rats are, and electronically flip back and forth between the two. If you get a real weak guy in one of those areas, you aim both antennas at him and blowtorch him, so to speak. What I used to have during the time I was using that antenna is that antenna at the 100-foot level. I had another single 432 Yagi at the 70-foot level hanging off the side of the tower on its yard arm, and I could aim them independently. So there was many an occasion in which I would leave one of the antennas aimed toward Boston and the whole array aimed toward Philadelphia, or the other way around, and flip back and forth between them. One other interesting experiment I did with that antenna is that by way of the relays that were in it, I could flip in such a way that only one single Yagi at the 105-foot level was operational on the upper antenna. One single Yagi at the 75-foot level on the yard arm with the lower antenna, and I would aim both of them in the same direction and compare signal strength. 99% of the time, the extra altitude gave me 10 decibels more signal on the single Yagi on the top of the antenna versus the single Yagi at the 75-foot level. 105-foot level versus 75-foot. So 20-foot of altitude difference, even though both antennas cleared the local terrain, cleared the trees, the extra altitude almost always gave me 10 decibels more signal. I did that experiment because Joe Reiser, W1JR, was writing articles, CQ Magazine at the time, saying that anybody whose antennas clear the trees, you're wasting your time to go any higher because you just get more feed line loss. Well, K1WHS, Dave Olean in Maine, and I both put a very strong crimp in that particular attitude because we both run out of experiments of various altitudes with similar antennas. The higher altitude always gives you more signal, with one or two very rare exceptions. Let me drop. And that is, on one or two foggy nights, there was a strange weather condition where for a short period of time, the lower antenna gave me 1 dB more signal strength than the higher antenna. But except for those couple of exceptions, the higher antenna, 99% of the time, would give me 10 decibels more signal. So when it comes to VHF, UHF, what makes an antenna work well? Location, location, location. Three things make it work well. And use every bit of altitude you can get, because every bit of altitude will give you more range, more signal strength for signals that are over the horizon. That's what I discovered with that array. I also discovered that if you've got enough antenna gain, enough transmit power, enough effective capture area on receive, and a low enough noise figure, there probably is no limit to the range that you can achieve. Once you emit a radio signal on a VHF, UHF frequency in particular, it goes to every corner of the universe, in my opinion. Nothing left to discuss is how strong is it when it gets there? Is it above the threshold of the equipment you're using to receive the signal? Aim a signal in the right direction. Have people with well-equipped antennas and low noise figures and transmitters on both ends, and I think almost any range can be overcome. When it comes to a 200 milliwatt signal on a 2-foot dish on 10 gigahertz, also at the 100-foot level, I've talked to people out to 380 miles on 10 gigahertz, single sideband, to Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. Talked to people in 10 states in that band. So the magic of radio is that as long as you've got good frequency accuracy, let me drop, so that you and the guy you want to talk to are both set on the same frequency, you don't have a whole lot of spend a whole lot of time scanning up and down the band to try to find each other, like many guys used to do on 432. There are ways with disciplining your oscillator system by using a global positioning satellite receiver, and the net result is you can get 1 hertz of frequency accuracy on the 10 gigahertz ham band, 10.368. Therefore, you guys, you and your buddy, let me pick a number, 700 miles apart, can say, okay, we're going to talk to each other on Tuesday night. You transmit on the odd minutes, I'll transmit on the even minutes. We'll aim our antennas at each other. We know exactly what frequency we're on. We'll keep doing that for the next hour or so until Mother Nature creates the right weather conditions in which we talk to each other, and we'll claim it as a contact. If you're within 200 miles of a major body of water, like the Atlantic Ocean, on the 10 gig band, for instance, you get a band opening every single 24-hour day. For some portion of that day, a signal with ridiculous range will get through. I'm looking forward to putting up a nice high-gain antenna on the 10 gig band and starting to run schedules with guys in Florida, 1,200 miles away, on 10,000 megacycles, single sideband. Once I set up the right kind of equipment on this end, and I can talk to somebody in the Florida setting up the right equipment on their end, I think it's just a matter of time before that gap is bridged. The nice thing between me out here in Huntington, Long Island, and a guy in the northern Florida is that 90% of that path is over water, and that helps an awful lot. So these are some of my plans and thinkings on arrays like that and the kind of fun you can have with them, Paul. WSQN, I wonder if it answers some of your questions. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, definitely. And I was curious about the actual failure. You know, was it a bolt that broke loose, a plate that came loose, or you know, like you said, the horizontal? I guess the horizontal boom must have bent or something, and then maybe broke loose from whatever you had it clamped to. You know, there's always some exact point. I realize the whole thing went over 30 degrees. You know, that's not good there. It's good that you can straighten the whole thing back up again. And I'm also curious about the rotator that you use, turning this
75 pound thing, Dick. Kind of rotated and you used back to you.
Yeah, funny you should ask. Let me drop. That is that for the first couple of months, that whole array, 75 pound array, 400 square foot of antenna, 3,500 cubic foot of antenna, volumetric antenna, was turned with a AR-22 Cornell Dubilier chintzy little rotator. I got away with that because that great big array had a weather vane on the back of it. There was a piece of tubing sticking out the back with a vertical piece of sheet metal about a square foot acting as a weather vane to correct the fact that each Yagi had a little bit longer length in front of the mounting point versus behind. So the antenna would tend to aim itself downwind by putting a weather vane on it and adjusting it to the right size. I made it wind rotation neutral, so the thing didn't tend to turn in the wind, and a very small rotator could turn it. I eventually put a ham M on it. So it was turned with a ham M. My only complaint was the ham M could only give me a couple of degrees of accuracy, plus or minus 2 or 3 degrees of aiming accuracy is all you can get out of the indicator, the azimuth indicator on a ham M rotator. Nowadays, I should use one of the more modern Yaesu rotators that have a little bit more accuracy on their readout device. Or maybe I should put a real shaft encoder on it when I build the antenna again. The antenna had a 5.5 degree beam width, plus or minus 2.75 degrees. So you'd really like to have aiming accuracy of 1 or 2 degrees if you could get it. That way you could peek up on guys. One of the things I discovered with that antenna is that during each one of those half-hour QSOs with K4CAW, 480 miles away, with the signal averaging a couple of dB out of the noise. During each QSO, about twice per half hour, the signal would slowly peak up to about 25 or so dB above the noise, hang there for a minute or two, and then go back down again, with whining sounds on the way up and on the way back down. That went on for about 6 months before we finally figured out what was going on, and that is we were getting aircraft reflection. When an aircraft is at 33,000 feet over Washington, D.C., the midpoint between Greensboro, North Carolina, and Huntington, Long Island, the aircraft was in the mutual beam of our two antennas, and it was up at a nice high altitude, so reflection off the airplane gave us a 25 decibel enhancement. I finally figured it out by the Doppler shifts of the whining sound as the signal would get stronger and stronger and then go from zero beat and then repeat out the other side the same way. Also, because I had a 5-degree beam width on the antenna, I could, on occasion when the signal started getting weak again after one of these enhancements, I could aim to the left or to the right of Great Circle Pass, and I could refine the aircraft. K4CAW, Al, had a broader beam width antenna than mine, so he was lighting up a bigger chunk of space. Therefore, if the aircraft was a little bit to the east or to the west of the Great Circle Pass, I could aim my antenna a little bit off of the Great Circle Pass, in other words, go to the right or to the left of Al, and pick up some extra signal strength when I was getting reflection off the aircraft. So the combination of watching the angle of peak signal and listening to the Doppler whines and so on, we eventually figured out that airplanes flying from New York to Florida flew over Washington, D.C., the midpoint. They were at 30-some-odd-thousand feet, and that's the enhancement we were getting. The significance of that is that around that time, a number of military organizations were running long-range TROPO experiments, tropospheric propagation experiments. They were doing the experiments by using great big antennas on both ends, high-power transmitters, and running strip shot recorders, and looking at the signal strength versus time, and calculating all of the statistics of that. But nobody was listening to the signal. It's a little bit like Ellie Arroway in the movie A Contact, where she was a radio astronomer in that science fiction movie, listening to what was coming into the radio telescope and found out some extra signals were in there and eventually figured out what the intelligence was in that science fiction. So by the same token, Al and I are sending these long-range signals, and obviously we were listening, and therefore we knew when funny things were happening. Therefore, when the Department of Defense is running these experiments, they don't realize that they had an awful lot of contamination in their data because aircraft reflection was in there. They thought they were measuring the tropospheric propagation characteristics of Mother Nature's atmosphere, but from time to time it was being contaminated by aircraft reflections. Because no one was listening to the strip chart recordings, they didn't know that, in my opinion. Now, when it comes to the actual failure, let me drop. The antenna had one major 2-inch diameter piece of horizontal tubing, which, as it went through the main mast in the center of the array at the tower, telescoped through another piece of tubing that was 2¼ inches diameter. That was going to be the elevation bearing by which the antenna was going to be tilted in elevation when I did moon bounce. When the high wind came along of 106 miles an hour, I think, from Hurricane Gloria, that main horizontal piece of tubing, which was 15½ feet long, snapped in the middle. The two pieces disconnected themselves from the telescoping section that was in the center that was supposed to be the elevation bearing. Those two pieces slipped out of that bearing, so to speak, and the whole array started coming down to the ground. There was another horizontal piece of tubing, even thinner wall and 1½ inches diameter, and that one also snapped. I think that one snapped first, disconnecting it from the tower. That was the one at the bottom horizontal piece of tubing, which was connected to a ring of sheet metal that went around the tower as a kind of a bearing, and the push rod that was going to elevate the antenna was going to operate from that lower one. Now, that one first snapped, and then the upper one, the upper horizontal piece of tubing snapped, and by then there were two vertical pieces of tubing on the left side, two vertical pieces of tubing on the right side, that each had four Yagis on them, and they came tumbling to the ground. Next time I build it, I'm going to use slightly thicker wall tubing, a little bit stronger array. Also, I did use crisscross guying with polypropylene rope, or was it nylon rope. You'll see two pieces of diagonal pieces of nylon rope acting like a teepee from the top of the mast to the bottom left-hand corner and the bottom right-hand corner of the antenna. That gave it vertical guying, so the thing didn't tend to sag on the thin wall piece of tubing. By the same token, had I been using some other pieces of nylon rope to guide the antenna in the forward and reverse direction, it would have had a lot more strength, and it wouldn't have had the much ability to bend those horizontal pieces of tubing. So with proper nylon rope guying techniques, and by using thicker wall tubing, when I finally get around to reproducing that array, and because, as I said, it was the most fun antenna I ever had, so I'm looking forward to doing that again someday, Paul. Next time I know how to do it better. I got 4½ years of service out of that antenna. I knew it had a failure, calculated failure of 76 miles an hour. It was supposed to fail. I didn't lose any sleep over that one. I had gotten my money's worth from my point of view. It's basically physics, if you know what I mean, Paul. Good antenna design to survive the wind and the ice storms and the winter and whatever, from my point of view, is no accident. In other words, when you design physically a piece of antenna like that, you are basically setting into motion weather...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You are determining ahead of time whether or not the wind is going to come along and make it fail, or an ice storm is going to come along and make it fail. You really are determining that at the time you construct the thing. Many of these things are calculatable. We all have tuned across the handbands and heard guys say that, gee, I built this beautiful antenna, or I bought a so-and-so brand name, and along came a windstorm or an ice storm and destroyed it on me. Well, some of those things shouldn't be a surprise. They are calculatable ahead of time. Wind loading characteristics is calculatable. Each time I describe to people what it's like to put a weather vane on the back of a long Yagi antenna in order to make it wind neutral, to balance it wind-wise, to make the center of wind pressure the same as the center of rotation, each time I describe that to ham radio operators, they say, why should I do that? And the answer is, so you don't grind up your rotator, so you can aim the antenna in any direction you want to on a windy day. Why would you not want to do that? It doesn't cost you anything in radio performance to add an extra piece of sheet metal vertically connected to the back of your boom on the antenna to make it wind neutral. Turns out that the elements of almost all Yagis are stacked closer together near the driven element and reflector and first director, and you've also got a piece of feed line going out there. So the back of the antenna is heavier than the front of the antenna. Therefore, you tend to put the mounting clamp aft of the center of the antenna. therefore there's usually more boom of the antenna sticking out in front than behind. That makes it non-wind neutral. That makes it act like a weather vane where the antenna has got more boom in the front than behind, and it always wants to aim itself downwind. On the windy day, it's going to sway back and forth and tend to grind up the gears of your rotator. A very simple procedure can correct that. As I said, each time I explain it to him, I say, why do I want to do that? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Question, Dick.
Go ahead, Mel.
Mel from the port, too, from the front back. I hear Mel. Good evening, Mel. Dick, over to you. Well, one other thing I was going to say, but I'll let Mel listen. Mel, go ahead, Dick.
Go ahead, Mel.
Now, what bent the tower? I was trying to understand. I could understand the boom split apart. What caused the tower to bend?
About 30 square feet of antenna called 16 Yagis with all of its mounting structure. 30 square feet of antenna mounted 105 feet on top of the tower, mounted 15 feet above the upper set of guy wires. My upper set of guy wires are at the 90-foot level. Row number 6 is fairly chintzy tower by modern standards. It's got half the strength of row 25. It's got one-tenth the strength of row 55, which I'm running right now. And so a fairly chintzy tower with a massive antenna, 35 square feet of area, 15 feet above the upper guy wire. When the wind blew against that antenna, it bent the tower over at a 30-degree angle downwind. The wind kept right on increasing, and eventually the horizontal mast failed, and the whole antenna got ripped off the tower. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, did you ever consider using one of those carriages that ride up the tower? I forget what they call them. They sell them commercially. I'm sure it's a homebrew version. So that if we are going to get a big blow, that you can lower it down to some extent, at least down to a point where, you know, it's nested into the tower with where the guy wires are, Dick, over.
Yes, that would be kind of nice if you're building a chintzy antenna like I did. I wanted to make the antenna light because I knew I was going to be hauling up the pieces manually and mounting them on site. In other words, I had to construct that thing at the 100-foot level of the tower. It's the only way to get it past the 12 guy wires. There's two solutions to that. First of all, that riding device, that elevator device you're describing, if you've got a self-standing tower, that would be nice. But when you've got four sets of guy wires, that tower is guyed at 30, 60, 30, 50, 70, and 90, every 20 feet. I've got a set of guy wires on that tower because it's a fairly chintzy tower. To get that thing to ride up with such a big antenna past all of those guy wires, it's almost impossible. To set up a self-standing tower at the 100-foot level, that's a serious engineering problem. I think a much better solution is to start off with a strong tower, a good strong set of guy wires, and build the antenna in such a way that it can survive 100-mile-an-hour wind. You and I, Mel, live in a 75-mile-an-hour wind area, according to all the weather statistics. Each square foot of land in our area of the country once per 50 years is going to be hit with 75 mile an hour wind or above. That's a once per 50 year event. So if I built an antenna and rated it in such a way that it's good for 100 mile an hour wind, I'm probably good for 150 years, if you know what I mean. So I think a better solution is a strong tower, a strong set of guy wires, and a strong antenna, and then stop worrying about the wind. That's the way I would approach it. Strong like bull approach, you know, belt and suspenders, K2KEY, K2LIW.
WHCDO have information on that.
Okay, Andy, second. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
I don't mean to lower it down, of course, you know, past all those guy wires, but if you had the capability, you said you had the guys at a 90-foot level of the 100-foot tower plus the mast on top, if you could just lower, had it on a carriage, just to lower the array down, say, to 90 foot to where the 30 guy wires are, possibility that that's possible would have saved the top piece of the tower from bending, and also at the same time, I don't know if it would have helped you with the antennas just to break apart, but I was just thinking that maybe when I nest into the, you know, more of the solid, against the solid power section, where it's guide that maybe you would have a better survival pick over.
Well, Roan 55 power is 10 to 1 stronger than Roan 60, Roan number 6. I personally have stood 40 feet above a guide station on Roan 55 tower. I will admit at the 40-foot level it starts getting a little bit whippy. You can push your body closer and further away from the tower and set it swaying. 30 feet above a guide station on Roan 55, it's quite steady. 20 feet above a guide station, boy, you think that that tower is, mounted in concrete 3 feet below where you're standing. It doesn't move, so to speak, except for the stretching of the guy wires themselves. On top of that, my Roan number 6 tower, when I stood at the 100-foot level, and as I said, it's got guy wires at 30, 50, 70, and 90 feet above the ground, every 20 feet, except for the first space of 30. I could push my body forward and reverse away from the tower and look down the tower and see it snaking back and forth in one double S curve. In other words, it would, between the odd and even sets of guy wires, I would see it. I would see the tower bulging to the left, to the right, or forward and reverse, so to speak. I would see this S curve dynamically moving down the tower as I push my body forward and reverse on the tower. Interesting experiment to do, if you don't overdo it, of course. I've done the exact same thing on a... one time I was standing on 180 feet of Roan 55 tower, and that was guide every 40 feet. And I looked down the tower as I pushed my body forward and aft, and I saw no snaking action of that tower. The whole darn tower would sway a little bit to the left and to the right as one great big piece, like a pencil, so to speak. The guy wires would stretch, and the tower would not have any snaking action to it. Roan 55 is a very sturdy piece of tower. Look, you use the right brand name of tower with the proper guying system, the tower is not going to bend, and it's not going to fall down as long as the guy wires don't fail. Then build the antenna strong enough, and it's not going to fail. So moving the antenna from the 100-foot level down to the 90-foot would give you very little protection. You're way ahead of the game to just make the signal, make the antenna strong enough to begin with. Wind failure of a tower, wind failure of a guy wire, wind failure of an antenna, ice failure of an antenna. All of these things are not magic. They're deterministic. With a little bit of mechanical engineering smarts and aerodynamic smarts, you can calculate that ahead of time. You can find out what direction is the most vulnerable direction, and at how many miles per hour is it going to fail. And you can decide if it's good enough, or you can add some extra strengthening techniques to the antenna itself. A good antenna design to survive the weather is not an accident. It is calculatable. It's engineering. It's good engineering, in my opinion.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's good engineering, in my opinion. Andy, your audio is a little bit low, so eat the microphone and start talking to us. But A2CDL, our technical expert at Limerock, K2RIW on the tech man.
Okay, I'm sorry. A little delay there. I just arrived. I gotta jump out of the car. Okay, I just wanted to mention the company Glenn Martin makes the Hazer, which is that movable platform that rides outside of the tower that you would attach a rotor to and hence the beam and everything else. And then it's motorized. But I've never actually seen it in operation, but I read a report just recently on one that failed. Apparently, they don't have any safety. If one of the cables gets damaged, I don't know the whole situation, but it was reported that the cable that raises it snaps for some reason, and the structure with the antenna came crashing down. Fortunately, and the guy was working on it at the time, he was not injured because my understanding is one of the side arms that's used to hold the coax cable prevented it from going any further down from where it landed. so he was spared, and he was underneath it at the time. Very dangerous. For some reason, they did not incorporate a safety feature in case that cable snapped. That's pretty scary, just to mention that. Back to you.
Yeah, I was waiting for the beep, and I forgot that you were getting into the machine by another means. Anybody who is on is using some kind of an elevator-like mechanism on a tower and mounts his body below that elevator, and the elevator is suspending a massive structure by way of a cable that goes over a pulley. Anybody who stands below that kind of an elevator is, in my opinion, taking a very high risk. For instance, if I and somebody else go up my tower, I make sure that they climb up the north face and I climb up the south face. So if they drop a tool, it doesn't hit me, even if I'm wearing a hard hat. I don't want a tool roaring through my shoulder, if you know what I mean. Every tool I've owned over all the years has at one time or another been dropped from my tower. I'm not quite smart enough like a mountaineering person where you make sure every single tool is tethered to your body with a separate lacing cord, so to speak. So tools get dropped, things get dropped. You've got to be careful. By the same token, when I'm assembling a tower and I go beyond the 75 or 100 foot level, I make sure that there's an auxiliary method of suspending the tower section that I'm hauling up so that it's connected to the tower in such a way that if the hauling mechanism fails, the tower cannot drop all the way to the ground, the tower section, because the tower section is a very strong chunk of steel. You drop it to 75 or 100 feet, and if it strikes a guy wire below you, it can easily create a failure of that guy wire and therefore collapse the whole tower below you. And that will really get your attention if you're on that tower at the time. It will make you extremely unhappy. So that, again, is a calculatable risk. When you read the accident reports of all the tower assembly that takes place in the United States every year, and on the average year, about 5 tower maintenance or tower assembling people die in the United States per year. Every one of those accidents is a calculatable, avoidable situation. The most prevalent accident that occurs is that while they're holding up a tower section, something fails, the tower section falls, cuts a lower guy wire, and collapses the whole tower. And everybody on the tower dies. And maybe one or two people on the ground, if they don't run away fast enough, will die. That accident happens once every year or two, somewhere in the United States. It is such an easily calculated situation as to how it can happen. Another silly thing that guys will do is that they're too lazy to climb the tower, so they connect themselves to the hauling mechanism and let the crane that's hauling up the tower section haul them up at the same time. And again, if a failure occurs, not only does the tower section drop to the ground, but the person that's standing on the tower section drops to the ground. A very dangerous procedure. So all of these things, in my opinion, are calculatable. If you've got a crank-up tower, and if you're going to...
repeater, timeout, cancel.
If you're going to try to unjam a structure that, you know, a couple of sections that got jammed together on your crank-up tower, a very dangerous procedure. Make sure you've got some kind of a safety mechanism that you can insert into each tower section as you climb past that tower section to make sure it cannot collapse below you, so to speak, while you're climbing on the higher sections. I've heard stories of people who will take a crank-up tower with something jammed, and they will climb the crank-up tower. And not only is that cable that holds up the individual sections under very high tension at that time, and it's holding up the tower sections themselves, but it's also going to be holding up the extra weight of the human being that's climbing the tower. Dangerous procedure. All of these things are calculatable. There was a tower accident that happened in Smithtown about 15 years ago where there was something like an 80-foot of Roan 45 tower which was held up with a bunch of guy wires, and guys were going to disassemble that tower. They're going to take it down. So there were a couple of guys on the tower disconnecting sections and lowering them to the ground with their own gin pole and pulley mechanism. There were another set of human beings on the ground disconnecting guy wires. The guys on the ground disconnecting guy wires got ahead of the guys that were on the tower, the human beings that were on the tower. And pretty soon there were no guy wires holding up the tower, and 30 or 40 feet of tower fell over with two human beings on it. Very silly accident. and those two human beings were heavily injured when they struck the lawn as the tower went over. So each of these situations are calculatable ahead of time, in my opinion. A tower that's held up with guy wires, the guy wires do 98% of all of the work of holding that tower up. The bottom of your tower could be in a zillion feet of concrete. It doesn't matter. 70 or 100 feet of tower that's held up with guy wires and the bottom section is a concrete chunk, that's not enough. You've got a huge moment arm there that's capable of buckling or snapping that bottom tower section if a little bit of wind or a little bit of unbalance occurs on the top of the tower if the guy wires are not holding it. Once you realize that the strength of a radio tower is primarily in the guy wires, then you better treat those guy wires with tender loving care, and you better really move very slowly when you're making a replacement of them. Another classic accident occurred on the tallest structure that is on Earth. It was Radio 1 in Plock, Poland. That tower was 2,250 feet tall. It was there for like 30 years, Radio 1 in Poland. They never bragged about this tower, but that was the tallest structure assembled by mankind on Earth. Yeah, there's a couple of mountains that are taller, but when it comes to mankind assembled structure, that was the tallest structure on Earth. The guy... The guy wires were becoming rusty. Radio 1 went out to get bids for vendors to replace the guy wires. The lowest bidder won the job. The lowest bidder replacing those rusty guy wires disconnected some of the guy wires before putting the new ones on. So